Irish Illustrated Insider subscribers. This is Drew Mentock, and I'm here to bring you the 15th episode from a bi-weekly podcast series in the feed, Irish Illustrated Interviews. Today, we're sharing my conversation with Mike Amaday, a lifelong Fighting Irish fan who's been the usher supervisor at the field level of Notre Dame Stadium for 22 years and an usher for 30 overall. That's given him a unique perspective into game day operations inside the stadium, where he's also interacted with famous Fighting Irish fans and legends on the sideline. That includes Jon Bon Jovi, Joe Montana, and Joe Theismann. We dive into the responsibilities of an usher and how he got to start wearing the distinctive uniform. Oh, and he shares some fun stories along the way. Mike is also the executive editor and curriculum development manager at Ave Maria Press, where he's worked for almost 33 years. There, he's acquired and worked on multiple books from former Notre Dame coaches with a statue on campus, specifically Lou Holtz and Muffet McGraw. We discuss what it's like to get to know both of these championship-winning head coaches away from the sports arena. Here's my interview with Mike. What's up, everyone? I'm here with Mike Amaday, a lifelong Fighting Irish fan who's been the usher supervisor at the field level of Notre Dame Stadium for 22 years and an usher for 30 years overall. You're also the executive editor and curriculum development manager at Ave Maria Press, where you've worked for roughly 33 years, according to your LinkedIn. In this role, you've acquired and worked on multiple books with former Notre Dame coaches with a statue on campus, Lou Holtz and Muffet McGraw. Full disclosure, my wife is on the board at Ave Maria Press, and Mike was my 7th grade baseball coach and freshman year basketball coach, meaning he's easily yelled at me and made me run more sprints than everyone else who's appeared on this podcast combined. Thank you for being here today, Mike.
Hey, no problem, Andrew. And you know, you didn't mention that those were two championship teams, right, that you played on?
I know we're pretty good.
Come on. I for sure they were championship teams, especially that freshman basketball team.
Yeah, I think we definitely won the city in a couple, maybe the end of year tournaments too. So I think you're right.
Yeah.
But I start off all my podcasts with kind of going back to like, what's your first recollection of Notre Dame? Before I emailed you, you sent me a photo that looks like maybe you're one or two wearing a Notre Dame sweatshirt and a football helmet. So I'm guessing that recollection goes back pretty far.
It does. I was always given Notre Dame sweatshirts like so many other kids growing up, you know, that were in Notre Dame families. I think about my grandmother, you know, she was born in 1896 in Missouri and then ended up in California, you know, Catholic woman. And she just loved Notre Dame. You know, she was a Subway alum. And then that translated to her kids, my mom, and especially my uncle, who was the guy who really got me into it. He was a World War II veteran. You know, he served in Okinawa and was never married, but he lived and died with Notre Dame. And so, starting when I was 9 years old, he would give me a ticket every 2 years for my birthday to the USC game. So 1966 was the first time. So if you want to talk about really the first memory, I mean, 1966, walking through the tunnel at the Coliseum, seeing that green field, gold helmets, and then 51-0, you know, was the final score. And, you know, I've said it before, it's always like, you know, you have a high like that and you're always looking to repeat it and really haven't ever got that same high again. But anytime you can beat USC, it's been great over the years. But then he and I went to games for every 2 years. So I went from 66 until 94 with him. We moved here in 93, but I went back for one more with him. So we went to every 2 years we went together. It started out with a couple of my cousins, but as they grew older, they kind of drifted away from it, but I stuck it out with him. And it was like just me and him going to those games. So some good times, but a lot of bad times in the 70s there at the Coliseum. Just the things that you don't want to go through, you know, 24-0 lead, ending up 55-24. Michael Harper of USC scoring without the ball, you know, to end the, I think, 82 game, but then some great wins, the 88 game. Tony Rice and all that national championship season were really good. So
that 1966 would have been to that game would have been to win a national championship, I assume, then, correct?
Yeah, the week after the 10-10 tie against Michigan State, so Era wanted to put it on them, you know, to make sure they got the vote, and they did. And Terry Hanratty, you know, had gotten hurt in the Michigan State game the week before, so the quarterback was Coley O'Brien. And, you know, he, the backup quarterback, led that win. So, and then, you know, 2 years, I never saw Hanratty play. 2 years later, 68, that was O.J. Simpson's Heisman season. Notre Dame really shut him down. And they got off to a 21-7 lead at halftime. And Joe Theismann replaced Hanratty in that game. And he threw a little swing pass to Coley O'Brien, who was now playing halfback in that game, who threw it back to Joe for the touchdown. And Joe launched, after he scored in the closed end of the college stand, he launched the ball up into the stands about two rows below me. My cousins and I scrambled for it. So I see Joe, you know, on the field. I love Joe. And I see him on the field at the stadium now. And I said to him, hey, Joe, I tell him the story. I'm like, do you remember tossing that ball up in the stands? It would have been right over in this area if this was the college stand. And he goes, yeah, I do. And I go, only thing I think is funny about it, I was in sixth grade and you were like a sophomore in college, and now look at us, you look like you're 10 years younger than me. He goes, yeah, you're right. Joe's still looking good, he's got that full head of hair.
That's great. Yeah, no, you're right, it's hard to, I'm sure, come off that you see Notre Dame beat USC 51-0, win a national championship. That's kind of you really started your official fandom off on a high.
Fandom on a high, and also my hatred for USC. I just can't stand them, and even more so this very day.
And so you grew up in California, but obviously you're out in South Bend now and have been for quite some time. What brought you out this way? Did it have something to do with Notre Dame, or was it kind of your role that you're in now at Ave Maria Press?
All Notre Dame. I, you know, I was a teacher and then wanted to get into journalism. And then kind of moved from teaching into Catholic book publishing. But I met the publisher of Ave Maria Press at a convention in Los Angeles, and actually in Anaheim. And, you know, we were talking about jobs and things. And he goes, well, I got to tell you, we're in the Midwest. This might be a problem. We're on the campus of Notre Dame. And I said, no, that's not going to be a problem. So I would not have come to Ave Maria Press if it was in Minnesota or Ohio or anywhere else. It was all about Notre Dame. And it was, you know, my love for Notre Dame. I mean, you know, I've just been a fan my whole life, and just it's been part of my life. I'm Subway alum through and through, you know.
What was it like once you actually got to South Bend and got to be around the team and I mean, right off campus or right on campus?
It was good. The first, 93 was the first season. So, you know, and I've grew up, you know, sneaking into Dodger Stadium and finding tickets outside from scalpers and all that. And I found it hard to get in a smaller stadium, and they were good, but I did get into every game. And, it comes down to the Florida State game, that, you know, game of the century. And it was tough to get a ticket. I had some buddies that came in for the game. Not name dropping, one guy's Jason Patrick, who was a movie star, is in like Lost Boys. At the school I taught at, and he had, I think there was four of them, and he had three tickets, or there was four of them, he had four tickets, and I didn't have a ticket. So at the end of the thing, he, right before the game, we were at the huddle, and he called over to NBC. He'd just come out with a movie, and he'd also just broken up with Julia Roberts, his girlfriend. And so his agent wanted to get him on the Today Show to talk about his new movie, but the Today Show wanted to question him about the Julia thing, and he didn't want to do it, but he changed his mind right at the end just for me. He called over there and said, hey, I'll go on the Today Show, but I need another pass right over there. So we walked over to the stadium, and I thought I was heading over to the linebacker to watch the game by myself. I walked over to the stadium, and Todd Christensen came down from the booth with this hand-scribbled pass and handed it to us. So now we have the extra ticket. Walked in, and we parlayed that one path that Todd Christensen gave us to getting us all down on the field.
Wow.
In the game. So we walked down the field. So I always tell the ushers down there, you know, once I got down there a couple years later, I'm like, man, you had no security at all, because we snuck down. I stood next to the boxer, Jerry Cooney, on the 30-yard line and watched that whole Florida State game. And so, yeah, that was the first season. So I loved it. I loved being here. You know, the next week was a killer, you know, Boston right. College. I just barely made my way out of the stadium. My daughter, oldest daughter, was like 7 years old, her first game. And she saw me like, just like barely moving to get to the car. I didn't think I was going to make it. I was going to have a stroke out there after that game.
Yeah, I bet. That was terrible. Dramatic after what they just won, too. So is that what made you start wanting to become an usher? I guess just the challenge of kind of getting tickets week by week?
Yeah, that's exactly right. And, you know, we have four kids. They all wanted to go to the games. And, you know, I could always get two. But so then I was over at the Loftus Center one day, you know, at lunch working out a little bit. And I heard these guys talking about ushering. And then I thought, hey, maybe I'll do that, you know. So the guy gave me the phone number of Cappy Gagnon, who was the supervisor of ushers. And I called him and we talked for a long time because he was the supervisor of ushers, but he's a huge baseball nut. And he's done a lot of, you probably know a lot of history of Notre Dame baseball. So we talked forever on the phone. He was also out in LA for a while living there. So we had some things in common. So I got along with him really well and, you know, started out that first year as an usher. The first year I took tickets, I was a gate usher. And he asked, like, hey, you can get paid if you want, but you got to stay out there, or you can just take tickets till the start of the game and then go watch the game. And I took that option. And back with the great paper tickets, I used to have my three kids, you know, we live like a mile from this thing, you know, little kids under 10 years old. And I put like three $10 bills on the table before I left and said, hey, if you want to walk down there and try to scalp, get in there, you can. And they would take the $10 and then stand by the gate and wait for me to have someone give an extra ticket for a kid, which they did. And then I would go hand it to my kids and they'd get in. We'd go from there.
That's amazing.
I know. It was different times. Cappy said, hey, after you get done with taking the tickets, you can go up and help another usher in the one of the tunnels, you know. So I would do that. And once I get up there, like, they didn't want me, you know, they didn't know who I was. And so after a couple games of it, I shouldn't be saying this now, but it's so long until I would just bring my backpack, you know, before 9/11, you can bring a backpack in there and stuff my usher gear in there and just go find a seat and watch a game. So.
Oh, that's amazing.
Yeah, that was the start. Yeah.
And so how did that kind of progress? Obviously, as I mentioned, you're the field level supervisor, but is it something you just got more involved with as you got more known? Or
the second year, you know, back then there was like 800,000 ushers. So I didn't really talk to Cappy after the beginning of the year. And he called me the following summer and said, hey, are you going to still do it? And I said, yeah, I think so. And he goes, well, I'm thinking of moving you. Do you have any preference? And I'm like, 50-yard line, that sounds good. And he's like, oh, how about the field? And I'm like, oh, yeah, that sounds even better. So he just moved me down the field. And so the second year I was in the tunnel, kind of just standing there. You know, I did a few things before the game and then just watched the game. And then the year after that, the ushers are arranged in like supervisor, captains, and ushers. He said, I'm going to make you a captain over on the visitor side. And I said, no thanks. I'm good. You know, I like what I'm doing as well. He goes, no, I kind of moved you down there just for that reason. And so I did 5 years on the visiting side down by the visiting band. And, you know, it was okay, except when USC came, you know, because I just don't like them and didn't like their band director and didn't like that, anything about them. And then that was probably, you know, the Pete Carroll era. So that made it worse. That was, I think, a little before that, but. So that's how that happened. And then after 5 years of that, the guy that was the captain over on the home side, when Notre Dame started the hospitality tents, he volunteered to go out there. I don't know why he did that, but he went out. He lost his job as home side guy, and he went out to the tents. And after one game, he changed his mind. He wanted to come back in. And so after the first game, Cappy moved me over there. And I loved it. It was like the Ty Willingham start of this Michigan game, and I'm like, oh, this is great over here compared to being on the other side. And then the guy wanted to come back, so Cappy said, well, I'll have a solution for you. So I came to the next game and the captains had a white cover on their cap, and I didn't know you could take it off. He goes, just pull that off. And so I pulled it off, and there was like a blue cap color under there, and he goes, okay, now you're like the assistant supervisor to me, and then became supervisor. So he goes, now you can walk wherever you want. And so that's how it happened.
Wow. So very just kind of like, I don't know, backdoor unofficial. Just
like that. Yeah, it's a little different now. You know, it's a little more, Cappy was a good leader, and so is Jim Smith, who's a really good leader. And then, you know, things now in the field are a lot different since COVID. There's not as many people down there. The two bands are off the field. There's a lot less people during the games. So a lot of the in-game work is kind of, you know, not as strenuous. You got to do a lot in the pregame. And then, you know, just kind of, I always think of it like a baseball umpire. You know, like you could have a great 8 innings, but something screwy could happen in the 9th and mess everything up, and that's what you're going to be remembered for. So, you know, you got to just stay diligent on the job, and not just me. It's like there's 25 ushers down there. We all have to do our job there, and we do it right, you know, it's going to be okay. So hopefully, yeah, it's always knock on wood.
Yeah. And what are some of those responsibilities? Like, I know when the media goes to the press conference, we usually go through the field and usher like opens the gate for us. But what are some other responsibilities or things you're doing, especially before the game, that are a priority?
Hopefully that usher only opens it at the 5-minute mark, right?
Correct. Correct. Yeah. And they announce that very often in the press box too. So we're
5:10, you know, we don't want that. There's all different. So there's four different spots, you know, and everybody has a different role, like the, and it varies points of the game. Things are busier for them. So the group that's in the tunnel section, you know, they have a lot of stuff going on in the pregame. You know, there's recruits that come that way, football recruits and Olympic sport recruits. One group goes left, one group goes right. There's also a lot of family and pregame passes down there, so they send those over to the home side. So they're very busy during the opening part of the game. They gotta move people away from that fire they shoot off, you know, as the team runs in, you know, that right. kind of stuff. Home side, it's there's a lot more dignitaries, you know, down there, and then also the football recruits. And I that's where I stay in the pregame. I take personal responsibility on that. I mean, to me, the most important thing for me is to make sure, you know, the recruits are those lifeblood of that whole program. Your job too, probably, you know, you want their name to be good. So I want to make sure they're treated well. No one's bothering them, that kind of thing. Everybody stays away from them. And they have a good experience. And then, you know, they go up in the stands, you know, a few minutes before the game starts. So that's the busy part there. South end group would have more responsibility, especially towards the end of the game, you know, clearing the field off, making sure no one jumps over, you know.
Yeah.
That's a big thing. And, you know, there's a visiting captain. And now he does a great job. He's very hospitable, much more than when I was over there. And he's nice to visiting groups and nicer than I was. even at the USC group. And, you know, he makes sure that they're in the right spot. So those are the main things. And then there's a support group down there from Monterey Security now. They're out of Chicago. And that some of the ushers were like, uh-oh, look, they're going to replace us. But I think it's a really good partnership because, you know, I was telling them, like, hey, the worst case scenario is someone jumps over and runs on the field, and, you know, during the game. And you've already failed if that happens because you're not supposed to let them down. And then don't make it a double fail by chasing them, because you look like a goof on YouTube forever. So let the Monterey people do it, or let the police do it. So I'm glad they're down there.
And so you mentioned kind of having to, I guess, kind of keep people or make sure the recruits are kind of separate. And I mean, how much do you follow that type of thing? Are you on top of recruiting and aware of who they are and kind of being like, oh, I know this guy is
not
a five star, or how much do you pay attention to that?
I follow you guys, you know, I listen to all that stuff. So, but I don't recognize them as much as there's some other ushers down there, a couple guys that do. And so, you know, like I have a guy that's with me, he'll go, oh, this is like so and so, you know, big running back out of the. And I can tell you one kind of cool story. So this happened last year. I was down there, and or it was before the game, and this guy about my age he grabs me. So like he's a gray haired man, right? And he grabs me and he goes, hey, I played on this field like in, what did he say, in the 1970s. I played right out here on this field. I'm like, wow, really? I go, what team? And he's like, USC. And I said, okay, and what's your name? And again, I grew up out there, so I do know all those players and know where they went to high school. So he tells me his name's Lynn Kane. And I go, oh, number 21. You also played at East LA College before. And his wife was amazed. And she's like, whoa. And so he was like basically like in the midst of that Charles White, OJ era. He was a good running back, and he also played for the Falcons. So he and I got a picture together, and his grandson was a linebacker recruit. You might know who he is, from Georgia. His dad played at Georgia. And so they came into the picture, and I said to the kid, I'm like, do you know how good your grandpa was as a running back? He goes, oh, he tells us, you know. So that was a good scene, you know.
Funny, yeah, that's funny. Great.
I really liked it. Yeah, like meeting up with that guy and made peace with the USC guy.
What was it like? I mean, you mentioned having to, you know, talking to Joe Theismann, and I assume there's a lot of other former, you know, Notre Dame legends and stuff around. What is that like for you? Do you ever get a little starstruck? Are you kind of over that part now that you've been doing it for so long?
Yeah, and I guess the California thing. I mean, I don't really get starstruck, but I do admire those players. I mean, you know, and we have a thing down there. We're not supposed to take photos with any of them, you know, and so I'll tell you two things about that. Like, one, Bon Jovi was down there getting photos with everybody, right? So I was just standing there trying to keep it like in order. And he was standing right next to me. I said, hey, I go, I just want to tell you, I go, I would get my picture with you too, but I'm not supposed to. So I go, just so you know that I'd like a picture too, but I'm not supposed to do it. And he goes, give me your phone. And so he took my phone and he flipped it on like the reverse and he did a selfie with me and him. I'm like, okay. So I got that. And then I'm a big, hope your listeners, Notre Dame fans, are bad with this guy. You know, like, I'm a big Tommy Rees fan as a player and as a coach. I mean, he, and I'll just say that he's the guy that was an 18-year-old freshman that ended that nightmares decade against USC out in the rain there. So I loved him since then. And so all the ushers down there know how much I like Tommy. And so he, whatever, you know, years he came back to coach, as he walked through, one of the ushers like, we're breaking the rule. We got to get a picture with you and Tommy. So I do have a picture with Bon Jovi and with Tommy. Those are, I think, my only two pictures down there.
I think that's reasonable if you have one or two specific people. Even Matt Kishore had one player he felt like he needed to get a picture with of all the players and people he's seen down there. So
it's good. It's nice. I became friends with Derek Mays over the years. And like, I have a friend who that is like a Kentucky Derby horse trainer, and like, he won the Kentucky Derby a couple times, and he needed some publicity help when they went to the Preakness. He actually won the Preakness too. So between the Kentucky Derby and Preakness, I guess that would have been 2012, I connected him with Derek and his partner Paul Berrettini, and they helped with the publicity for my friend Doug O'Neill at the Preakness. So if you look back at the 2012 Preakness photos at the finish line, Derek is sitting behind Doug at the finish line cheering. And Derek told me that's the first time I ever been in the horse race. And we had a great time back there. We had a really nice suite and tent. And Derek brought Skip Holtz in. And, you know, we were all partying in there during the race. So that all came through just meeting somebody on the field.
And how, you mentioned a lot of your responsibilities are maybe before the game starts. How much are you able to actually like follow the game?
Well, I tell the ushers, you know, like, so I meet with them, you know, I have a meeting with the supervisors, with Jim Smith early on, then we meet with the ushers and the 25 or so. I said, man, if we all just do our job, we can enjoy the game too. If you just don't just watch the game, do your job, and then we can enjoy the game. So I watch the game. Yeah. Once I'm done, I'm really focused on the game. And, you know, I it's a perfect job for me because I'm so nervous during Notre Dame games that I can pace. So I pace from like one side, and it's part of the job, the circle field. So I'm pacing. I'm looking for a spot with like, I won't, it's a Catholic school, so I won't say karma, but I'm looking for a spot where I'm really feeling it. You know, I feel the inspiration, like things are going well. If it's going well, I'll stay there for a while. If not, I'll go to another spot. I look for people that have a good positive energy to them. Notre Dame people with like good energy. I'm like, I'm going to stay near her, this guy for a while. You know, that kind of thing. If someone's bringing some bad luck, I'll just move on. So I watch the game and, you know, I remember the wins, but you always remember the losses, like where you're at, you know. Last year, like the, you know, the last play against A&M, I was standing right there. It killed me. The Ohio State a couple of years ago killed me.
Oh, yeah.
You know, things, you know, just the Reggie Bush thing. That was a killer. Actually, on that one, I was standing next to Joe Montana and his wife, and I had my medal out, and I was just saying Hail Marys, and Joe's wife turned to me, and I must have been just like freaking out. She's like, "Are you going to be okay?" I don't know. I guess I'm not after what happened at the end. So,
oh, that's incredible. Is that usually what you do? Say Hail Marys, or are you allowed to cheer? I don't know the protocol.
I mean, I'll let out a few cheers, but you know, yeah. I mean, I'll just like Jerry Faust, I'll say some Hail Mary, you know, for sure. He said a lot of them during the game. You know, they work. You know. She's a fan, you know, you got to just say, I mean, I can tell you can feel it. You know, she loves football. This is a big thing for her. You know, she roots for the Irish. And like Lou said that, you know, like, you know, God doesn't care who wins, but his mother does. You know?
I've heard that.
Yeah.
So what are some of your favorite memories that you've had since you've been down on the field? You mentioned the tough losses, but what are some, even if it's not just the biggest wins, but some moments that really stick out to you over the years?
I mean, I enjoy the whole thing. I mean, it's you know, I'm so grateful to be down there. And so that's like the overarching part of it. And, you know, it started so long ago that, and I've never missed a game. And back, you know, when you were growing up and, you know, my kids were growing up and coaching those youth sports, I used to like coach the YMCA and coach Little League and always, you know, tell them like, hey, I can't do anything. I mean, I'm going to make the game so I can coach like YMCA basketball or whatever, but it has to be an 8 o'clock game, 9 o'clock in the morning game so I could get there. So I just appreciate being down there. I mean, yeah, I mean, as far as particular games, you know, that Indiana game last year was, God, that was a great atmosphere. That was just perfect. Every USC win is just great. I mean, this last year was tense. I mean, you know, I'm just tense through the whole thing, but when it's over, it's just like feeling great, you know. Pittsburgh and Stanford 2012, those last minute things, you know, were awesome, but, you know, everything's good, you know, and some of them blend together, and, you know, again, the losses hurt a lot down there. You know, that's for sure. I hate being down there when the other team's celebrating and, you know, most of the fans are gone and like, you know, you're probably off doing your work, but those teams, sometimes they go in the locker room, they come back out, and we still have to stay there and just go through all that, you know, miserable. And like back to the USC thing, you know, when they came in, and one of my proudest moments as an usher is that when I first started doing it, that band would be down there like 2 hours before the game playing their stupid music, and then after the game they would win or lose, even they would want to do this, they called it a concert, for like 30 minutes after the game. And you know, I wrote an email over to Notre Dame, I'm like, you gotta like limit that, and they did. They put them on like a 10-minute clock, and I stood by the guy's ladder, the conductor's ladder, and I had the clock going, and I like 1 minute to go, and the guy would be yelling down at me like, you know, yelling stuff I can't say on here. And then I'd start shaking the ladder if he didn't come down, just to get them off. So and you know, if they've won the game, it's even worse. Just want them out of there.
Definitely. Yeah. Something else I've wondered, I mean, I've been down there at the end of the game for when fans were either potentially getting ready to storm the field or were definitely going to, like after Clemson in 2022 and stuff. How, I mean, obviously there's only so much you can do.
Right.
How do you prepare for that? And how?
Yeah, there's a lot of preparation. The Notre Dame security police and Jim Smith, the Monterey staff, all those, you're anticipating that. So, you know, I always tell them, like, I don't mind it because that means they won a big game. And we got to stay there long, you know, a little bit after the game anyway. It's not that much longer to get the kids off the field, but you don't want them to do it in like minor games, you know. And so there is preparation. And then if like the Clemson game, if they come over, you go from trying to prevent it if you can to just helping them so they don't get hurt when they jump over. I have shown like the Indiana game, you know, like I think I have a good technique. I go right over to the student section. I start with the freshmen. I'm like, hey, you know, this is Notre Dame. This isn't a big enough game to jump over. Don't jump over. And if you just tell those first few rows that, and I also get the leprechaun to help and some of the cheerleaders because they got all their stuff down there. They don't want to get trampled. So they're over there doing that as well. And I think that works pretty well. So I think it's only happened a few times since I've been down there. And the times that it's happened have been, we were ready for it and planning for it. So,
yeah, I think that's been an interesting thing in college football in general, where it's not, I feel like it used to storm the field when you beat the number one team at home. And now it's kind of gotten to, I mean, sometimes it's just a ranked win or a rival or something like that. So it kind of seems like you probably have to be more prepared for it than you even used to previously, because people just almost want the experience more than celebration.
Yeah. I think the Notre Dame students know that the last game of their senior year, they're going to get to come down on the field. So maybe that helps. So, you know, I don't know. I mean, and then a lot of them, in the weather situation, you know, a lot of them do want to just turn and go home, you know. Yeah, it's, if it happens like, you know, the Texas A&M game, you know, we were getting ready for it to happen. And then I had to like switch gears and go down the other side. I was like, that was a long walk for me, you know, because we were trying, I was giving my speech to the kids, like, don't come over and stuff. But everyone was getting prepared. And then, you know, as they drove in for that last score, I flipped and went back the other way because I definitely didn't want the other team's fans coming over.
Oh, definitely.
Yeah.
And something else I want to ask you about is, I know your son, James, I believe he's also started becoming an usher. What's it like to kind of get him involved with that, and how has he enjoyed it?
Yeah, thanks. Yeah, James, I think he was like a little kid when he played basketball. He used to travel along with us. So he got, you know, he's on the autism spectrum, you know, and stuff. And I remember when we found that out, like he was about 4 or 5 years old, and you know, we find out. And so I went right from the, like, hearing that, like, you know, whoa, this changes your life, you know. And I remember I went right up to the Little League park to sign up the other kids for Little League. And I'm up there and I see a buddy of mine, a guy he knew, and I'm talking, and I said to him, like, man, I just got some news about James. And he knew James, that he was diagnosed on the autism spectrum. And I go, whoa, this is going to even kind of change my life a little. And he goes, hey, all I know is that in 15, 20 years, he's going to be wearing that goofy usher hat just like you. And he's going to be ushering with you. And he was right. He predicted it. So we're grateful. I was grateful to Jim Smith for, hiring him. And now James ushers a lot more than me. He ushers like all the basketball, hockey, lacrosse, all kinds of stuff. And it's great. He loves Notre Dame. And definitely football. He does that too as well. So he's a main man over there.
Nice. So glad he enjoys it. I remember him just being able to, being obsessed with sports as a kid and reciting stats and being kind of amazed. So I'm glad he's found another outlet for that.
He's selling collectibles now on he's got his own store. So he's all into sports, that's for sure.
Awesome. Yeah. And pivoting to your I guess your day job, mentioned at the top of this that you've, you know, worked with Muffet McGraw and Lou Holtz, who at the time of recording this, he's having some health issues. So we're definitely thinking about him and see what happens there. But you worked on three books with him, A Teen's Game Plan for Life, Three Rules for Living a Good Life, and A Lifetime of Love. I'm kind of curious what were...
There's Teen's Game Plan for Life. There's the other one, oops. Three Rules for Living a Good Life, and A Lifetime for Love. Oops, there you go. So
And what was it like? I mean, everyone saw him on ESPN or as a Notre Dame coach or in those light, but what was it like to maybe get to know him behind the scenes and on a personal basis for very different projects that aren't necessarily football based too?
Yeah, it's great. He's a good man, a good Catholic man, and I really admire him. He's one of the guys whose voice has kind of run through my head, like all the stuff he said. He's a real motivator. But yeah, I mean, the first book that we did was The Teens Game Plan, which he was out of coaching right after he left Notre Dame in between South Carolina. And it was based on a talk he gave to high school students. So we did the book, and then he got the job right as the book was starting with South Carolina. And prior to, as we were putting the book together, he said, "Hey, I'm not going to be able to do much promotion on it, but you can put the book together for me." But I got him to agree to come to California to do this convention that's like 10,000 Catholics in an arena, 30,000 Catholics attend the convention. And he agreed to it in September, and the convention was in like February. And so right before he's ready to go, he was the keynoter. He called and didn't want to do it because it was recruiting time. But then I talked him into doing it. And he said, "Okay, but I'm going to fly in. I'm going to get in there late at night." And then his flight got delayed. So he was stuck on the tarmac in Atlanta for like 3 hours plane. And his secretary was calling me like, "He's not pleased," and this and that. So I picked him up at 2 a.m. at LAX. I hadn't met him yet in person. We just worked over the phone. And I go, "Hey, I'll have a Notre Dame cap on. I'll be waiting by the baggage claim." So he came down and he said, "Hey, give me your keys. I'm going to drive your car." I'm like, "Huh?" And he's like, I'm in California all the time. I know my way around. And I actually want to get a milkshake at McDonald's." And it was 2 a.m. I said, "Hey, coach, I don't think it's open." I go, "But there is an In-N-Out Burger up here that I think is 24 hours and we can cruise up there." And he goes, "Oh, yeah, I've heard about that place." And so we left the airport. I said I would drive because I'm from California. So I'm driving. I looped around and the line at the In-N-Out was huge, like all these cars. So we didn't do that. He put his chair back and then we drove the 40 miles to Anaheim. And it was just great talking about like all the old games and all the games I saw, why he loved Notre Dame, he was talking about his recruiting at South Carolina. So we pulled into the hotel area at like 2:30 a.m. And there was some nuns coming and checking in the hotel for this convention. Who knows why at 2:30? He goes, "What are these nuns doing here?" And I said, "Oh, it's a Catholic convention, coach." And he said, "Oh yeah, yeah." And he said, "What are they going to say when they see Lou Holtz walking in the lobby at 2:00 a.m? I'm like, "Well, you can say the same thing back to them. And what are they doing here?" And he goes, "Oh, yeah, that's a good point." And so he did a great talk on the next day. And as we're walking over to do the talk, it was from 10 to 11:30. He tells me that his return flight's at 1 p.m. Out of LAX. And he was going to end at 11:30. I'm like, "Oh, my gosh." And I'm like a real conservative driver. And so I pulled my car up to the thing. I paid a guy $20, put the car right by the exit. And this is right across from Disneyland. So it's like 20 minutes just to get to the freeway from this convention through the Disneyland traffic. And I'm like, he goes, "Oh, you know what? I've never missed a flight in my life. Never." And so I finally made it to the freeway. I was doing like 90 in that express lane, with two people in your car. And the coach was just happy about his talk and just talking about Notre Dame, money that he made off all these books went to his foundation, which is good. And so that was good. In fact, the teens book, the justice system for juveniles in LA, still buys copies every year for all the kids in the juvenile justice system, and they have to read it and write a report on it.
Oh, wow.
And then once Lou heard about that, he started buying the books for everybody. So just it's been great working with them. The last book he did was on his marriage with Beth, his wife, and his kids helped with the book. He really put a lot of time into that and a lot of care. And if you want to have a good marriage, I would say, it's a good book to read. There was a real love between them, married to a football coach, you're getting that kind of story too. He said, like, every time they moved to a new house, first thing he would do was set up the trampoline in the front yard so that all the neighborhood kids would come over. And he goes, and I knew my kids were set, you know, had some friends. And, you know, he had other things like every Wednesday, they would honor one of the kids in the family. You know, they'd focus on the one kid in the family, and just another really good idea. So, you know, his kids are great. They're really caring for him now. I know that he's home and stuff. So just a good man. Like I said, his voice runs through my head a lot.
What made him, or you want to, I mean, obviously we've heard a lot of quotes, and he's always pretty clever with some of his phrases, but kind of getting away from football and giving some life advice, like what was the inspiration behind doing that?
Some of his quotes now?
These aren't really football books. They're, you know, more about life lessons and stuff, wanting to get more down that path.
Yeah, I mean, well, like I said, the first one was addressed. It was a message for teens addressed to an entire student body at St. Thomas Aquinas High School in Florida. So that was the basis of that book. The second one was his three rules for living a good life. You know, he was getting, you know, like thousands of dollars to give speeches. In the prime, you know, he had an agency that sponsored him. I think I heard at one point $30,000 a speech. So he did a lot of commencement speeches. So the second book, you know, his three rules for living a good life, you know, basically do the right thing and, you know, always give your best, those kinds of things. That was the basis of the second book. So, yeah, I mean, we're a Catholic publisher, so we had to have some spiritual bent in the book. We're not going to do a sports book. That's for someone else to do. So that Christian spiritual message, motivational message, the marriage book as well, you know, speaks well to Catholics who are married and then other people as well. Other people that want to have a good, successful marriage.
What was it like? You mentioned kind of meeting him for the first time in that kind of whirlwind story. What was it like getting to know him over the years and working on him with multiple projects?
He's just been not friends where we call each other up, but every time I talk to them, he's really treats me as a friend. Like I would see him, you know, on the field, even the last couple of years, you know, even when he was, you know, he had to come out on a cart. I would always make sure to go over there and I was like, hey, it's Mike, your editor from Ave Maria Press. You know, like you see someone in a different space with a goofy hat on. Oops, I shouldn't keep saying that. It's an usher hat. But when he'd see me with a hat on and he'd say, oh yeah, Mike, you know, how's the book doing? And I heard it's a bestseller now. He was like really into that. He was into the numbers of the book. And I'm like, it is, coach. You got three bestsellers. And so we would talk that way. And then I did a book myself about a year ago for older Catholics. And I asked coach to endorse the book. And I'll always love that. And the little thing he wrote, he said, you know, Mike's one of my good friends and I've known him for many years. And that was kind of a blurb he put on the book. So
that's amazing.
Yeah. Yeah.
And then you did, as I mentioned, another book with Muffet McGraw. It's titled Expect More. Sorry, I have the full title. Expect More, Dare to Stand Up and Stand Out.
Right.
I know that somebody from school days that you've known for a while too, but what was it like to work on that project with her?
Yeah, that was right during COVID. So, and she had just retired, you know, at the end of the season. So what would that have been, March, and COVID hit at that point. And, you know, I was stir crazy and did have to go home for a couple months to work from home. And so, you know, just on a lark, I kind of sent an email over there to coach and asked if she wanted to do a book, explained, you know, how I did it with Coach Holtz, that we could, you know, work side by side and help her through the process. But she just picked it up right at that point and just started turning out some writing during those next couple months. And we put the book together really fast. And, you know, it came out, you know, in the peak of COVID. I remember we here at Ave Maria Press, you know, we're on the north side of the campus across from the seminary. We did a book signing in the heart of COVID, where people had to drive their cars up, and she stood out in the parking lot, and the car, you know, we're past the Notre Dame Credit Union, past the circle. It was almost down, heading towards Ironwood. Other people, it was a couple miles away from the site here with this line of cars just to come in and get the book and get her autograph. So it kind of kept us happy during COVID. And, you know, and she was another person that was really good to work with. I learned a lot from her on just the winning mentality that she had. You know, she's just a real winner. And, you know, the other thing that was kind of funny, the way she had to still at that level deal with, you know, parents that wanted their kids to be playing more. And, you know, she told one story where one of her assistants went out to recruit somebody and came back and said, "Coach, you're going to love this player. Just the talent they have, this is the position we need." And said the assistant said, "But the one thing about her is that she was kind of always like looking up in the stands at her dad during the game." And Coach McGrath said, "I don't want her," you know? Yeah. And I really appreciated that kind of stuff, you know, like parents calling into her saying, "Why isn't my daughter playing?" And she goes, "Call your daughter. Don't ask me." So she's a gamer, you know, for sure.
Definitely. And kind of wanted to wrap things up with kind of a big picture. As you mentioned, you've gotten to see up close in football, Notre Dame football programs up close since the 1960s, obviously more so over the last 30 years. What has it been like to kind of see things progress from maybe in the, I guess, late 90s, where things kind of went away from football a little bit, to how they progressed through the 2000s and today with Coach Freeman?
Yeah, I mean, this is a good time. You know, I'm still just sick to my stomach over what happened this last year that they didn't get in there. I mean, seriously, it ruined my Christmas. I'm not over it. And, you know, I think it was just so unfair and, you know, whatever ESPN did to them, you guys can talk about all that. But yeah, I mean, I love Coach Freeman and I love the effort that you can just see. I mean, the new facility they're building, you know, the taking on of undergrad transfer students now, that they're going to be serious about this. And I think that it really fits well with Notre Dame, because everything that the other teams are doing is the same as Notre Dame's doing, but Notre Dame has the extra bonus of they're going to actually help these kids also to get a degree if they want to, you know, if they want to work hard, get a degree from Notre Dame. I mean, it's I don't think you can beat it, you know. And then yeah, Coach Freeman, who wouldn't want to play for him if you're a kid, you know, someone that's young and, you know, can care for them like he does, relate to them like that. You know, I hope he stays. You know, I hope he doesn't go anywhere. And, you know, I hope they win, you know, with him. And that, you know, some people say, well, after he wins, he can go, well, yeah, I want him to win first, but I would love for him to stay as long as he can.
Is there anything being on the sidelines that you've noticed that's either different about the team with him or about the way he kind of conducts himself that kind of stands out to you?
Yeah, I mean, all the coaches have been different down there, you know, to be near. And, you know, I back to that rule of not bothering anybody down there. I don't want to bother him. But yeah, I mean, I like the way he comes out and interacts with, you know, recruits, especially. He spends some time when could be preparing, you know, for the actual game. I mean, I'm sure they all do that, something like that as well. They need to do that. But yeah, I mean, he the emotions he wears on his face, I would say, are a lot like mine. like you can just, he like just feels it, you know, and he feels like the joy, but he also feels like the frustration, and he knows he's on camera. And, you know, so I really like a coach like that, you know, I'm feeling pain sometimes. I want the coach to feel pain and I want the coach to feel happy, and he does. And so I like riding the emotional train with him. So, you know, kind of similar in that way. And love seeing his family. You know, he has a great family. All the kids down there at the end of the game, you know, throwing the football around and stuff when the stadium clears out. It's great to see, you know. That's a good person for Notre Dame. And there's no one better, really. You know, you couldn't draw it up any better than Coach Freeman.
Yeah, that's even, I mean, Pete Bavakwa said that at his press conference in December. So I think that's a sentiment that's held across campus.
I agree with that. Yep.
Well, that's all the time we have for today. Thank you so much for being here today with me, Mike.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Hey, good luck with everything and keep doing the good work.
Thank you. And for everyone listening, we'll be back again in 2 weeks. Bye.